B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Fat Tuesday, February 28th, 2017. And we're seeing a wave of threats against Jewish community centers and other facilities across the country, accompanied by a wave of demagoguery, pointing the finger everywhere except at the Breitbart crowd. So the president is giving a speech to a joint session of Congress tonight. As we explained, during the first year of a presidency, they don't call it a State of the Union message, but that's what it is. And he's expected to brag about himself, talk about his huge Electoral College victory, and all that crap that he's been bragging about for almost 5 weeks now. And it is interesting because he went on his favorite TV show. He's told us. Fox and Friends, they're so friendly to him. They never ask a tough question or embarrass him. Talk about things that really matter. So he went on the TV this morning, and among other things, he responded to a question by blaming President Obama for the Women's March that occurred the day after Trump was inaugurated, for the airport protests, for the other street protests that have broken out pretty organically across the country since Trump was sworn in. And there is absolutely no evidence that President Obama or the organization that he started, OFA, Organizing for America, has any direct responsibility. If anything, these are groups of local people who've gotten together to share their outrage and their pain in the era of Trump. But he doesn't get that. Now, he didn't today suggest that these were paid protesters, but many of his allies have said that, again, with zero proof. And if I knew that Democrats were orchestrating these protests the way Democrats orchestrated fake news for Hillary during the campaign last year, I'd tell you right now. But there is no evidence of that. So, asked about whether Obama was involved in organizing protests, including the recent spate of raucous Republican town hall meetings, yeah, right, Obama is calling people and saying, go get rowdy with your member of Congress. And the protesters are being as tough on weak Democrats as they are on the right-wing Republicans. But asked about this, Trump said, I think he is behind it. I also think it's just politics. That's just the way it is. You never know exactly what's happening behind the scenes, he said. I think that President Obama's behind it because his people are certainly behind it. Now, I don't know the extent to which Organizing for America is directly responsible for any of these protests. There are many other groups that have been active. Many are not directly aligned with the Democratic Party. And the group of former Capitol Hill staffers who put out their memo on how to protest like the Tea Party did, they were not induced or inspired by Obama or his allies to do that. And Trump even suggested that some of the leaks that have surfaced possibly come from that group. Now, possibly is a weasel word, and so we can't take this as a real serious allegation. It's hard to take anything he says as serious. But it's fair to say that the leaks about the Russian phone calls that recently appeared in the New York Times probably came from people who used to work for Barack Obama. Now, the Washington Post said they had 9 sources, and so did the New York Times. They described them as present or former intelligence officials. Now, James Clapper, who used to be the director of national intelligence, has flatly said it's not him. But he's a proven public perjurer, so I can't vouch for his comment either. And here's an unusual comment. I'm reading from an account from the Guardian newspaper. In the Fox interview, Trump further disparaged Obama's immigration policy, saying the former president had deported a lot of people, in contrast to his own administration, stepped up deportation measures, which were focusing on a very bad group. Now, I don't know how you square those two comments, because it is true that Obama deported about 2.5 million people while he was president, set a new record. But apparently he's suggesting that he only sent good people home, not the bad guys, the bad dudes, the bad hombres that Trump says he is protecting us from. And one of the cases, as you may know, one of the bad dudes is a Salvadoran woman fighting deportation who was removed by immigration officials from a Texas hospital where she was being treated for a brain tumor. And they returned her to a detention center because, after all, she's second class at best, and whatever happens, she deserves, right? So we have this wave of graveyard disturbances in Philadelphia. A Jewish cemetery was defaced, vandalized over the past weekend. And on Monday, by one count, 19 Jewish community centers in 12 states all received bomb threats. Now, I assume that most of these threats were made by telephone. And in the age of caller ID, it's hard to imagine that you could orchestrate all those phone calls and nobody is able to trace them. But so far, no group is claiming responsibility for these attacks on Jewish communities. And in case you're not sure, I flatly deplore these activities. They don't have any place in a civilized nation. And the threats were called in Alabama, Delaware, Florida, Indiana, Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Virginia. I think I said one of those before. And also here in San Francisco, where the Anti-Defamation League had to vacate its offices after a threat was called in, another to a Jewish community center in Palo Alto, Silicon Valley. So this is disturbing. There's no question about it. But what's even more disturbing is that an ally of the president, one of his millionaire or billionaire cronies, a guy named Anthony Scaramucci, took to Twitter to imply that these threats could be coming from Democrats. Now, this is demagoguery, pure and simple. And as I headlined the podcast today, demagogues have no shame and no limits. So Scaramucci is saying, don't look at far-right white supremacist groups that read Breitbart News every day. No, it's probably angry Democrats who just haven't gotten over that Hillary lost. Scaramucci's tweet, it's not yet clear who the JCC offenders are. Don't forget the Democrats' effort to incite violence at Trump rallies. So his opening line in this tweet admits that nobody knows. But that doesn't stop him from pointing a finger. And here's another tweet from him. No, I'm saying until we know for sure, it's highly irresponsible to jump to conclusions. But meanwhile, I will smear the opposition party. And using demagogue tactics, just throw out the suggestion, because there are a lot of suggestible Americans who are eager to believe this kind of bullshit. And we know the suppressed Homeland Security report from 2009 shows that the greatest threat of domestic terrorism comes from white radicals with access to weapons, not from brown people or Muslims. So we got Rick Santorum popping up on CNN last week, implying without any evidence that the wave of anti-Semitic hate crimes is largely coming from Muslim Americans. Yeah, let's point the finger away from white people. And this really shows just the extreme racism that infects the right wing in this country. They don't need facts. They don't need evidence. They don't need proof. Because when you go on TV and spout this bullshit, there are enough people who will believe it some of the time. It gains traction, it becomes an urban myth, Urban myths become reality when they're embraced by certain media outlets. And that's the process that they are using. Now, one of other, another big complaint of Trump's is all these leaks. And I do, at certain moments, feel sorry for Trump, because there are leaks coming from almost every direction, including, pretty clearly, members of his own White House staff who are pissing outside the tent from inside the administration. But the battle of leaks has to start by getting the White House to take a pledge not to use official leaks. And I've just learned that tonight's joint address to Congress has been leaked by somebody in the White House to Alex Jones and the fine folks at InfoWars. That's an official leak. That's okay in the mind of the president. Last weekend, the White House enlisted two unnamed sources, a senior intelligence officer in the Trump administration and a senior member of the intelligence community, to talk to reporters as part of an effort to knock down the New York Times story about Trump associates' contact with Russia. And White House background briefings continue as always, meaning that White House officials are by design quoted in news stories as anonymous sources. So he wants us to continue to absorb the leaks of his partisans, but wants some sort of official mechanism to crack down on leaks that he doesn't support. Now, in this joint address to Congress tonight, the president will be grandstanding, and presidents do. They all do. And, of course, the First Lady's box is where they park people who will be featured on camera at a certain point during the speech. And Trump didn't bring Bill Clinton's alleged paramours, or he hasn't invited them so far, but he has invited the survivors of individuals who lost their lives as a result of altercations with non-citizens, with what Trump will call illegal aliens. And I'm sorry to see that two of them come from California, Jessica Davis and Susan Oliver. They're the widows of two California cops who were killed in the line of duty by a Mexican immigrant who was in the country illegally. And these losses, tragic as they are, will be used to justify the sweeping dragnet travel ban, immigration limits on people from certain countries, the bizarre and unfounded scheme to build a wall to keep people out of our southern border. And all this is wrapped up in a beautiful racist package. And I am really grateful that the parents of Kate Steinle, who suffered the tragic loss of their daughter in a bizarre incident on the waterfront in San Francisco. Kate Steinle, beautiful woman, early 30s, took a walk with her dad down the pier and was shot by what we're told was a stray bullet that was fired by an undocumented man who had been deported 5 or 6 times before. He'd been released by the San Francisco County Jail as part of the so-called sanctuary policy, when in fact, ICE did not ask for him back. So ICE screwed up, but they blame the former sheriff, my friend Ross Mercurimi, here in San Francisco. And the other ugly aspect of this case is that the gun that was used to fire the bullet that killed Kate Steinle came from a stolen weapon, a weapon that had been stolen from a federal officer from an unlocked car. Now, there are many things that this Steinle case may call for remedies to, but nobody's talking about the federal officer who didn't keep control of his firearm. And that if that hadn't occurred, nobody, legal or illegal, would have been able to pick up his gun and fire that shot that killed Kate Steinle. But of course, this is too much information, it's too rational, doesn't fit into a soundbite, and it doesn't form the basis of a scurrilous attack. Nevertheless, I'm grateful to the Steinleys for not allowing themselves to be used as props. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work. with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Steve Wozenski, Benny Alto, Faith Peoples, Patrick Garay. I appreciate your ongoing support. You are extremely generous. And it buoys my spirits. It affirms my work. So if you want to buoy me and affirm me or whatever you want to do to me, come on over and take out a subscription. PeterBCollins.com. You click on menu, you pull it down, click on become a subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page, and in minutes, you can be all set. We're now in the 16th year of what I call the whatever war. Americans have long forgotten and lost any concern over the military presence that continues to this day in Afghanistan. They were persuaded by George W. Bush that we had no choice but to invade Afghanistan because they were harboring Osama bin Laden. And we're told that bin Laden is gone. There have been no further attacks by his people in the United States. And yet we're expecting to be in Afghanistan on an endless basis. And I don't know if it'll come up in the speech to Congress tonight. I kind of doubt it. But Trump, I think, will most likely add more troops. He'll have his own beautiful, huge, incredible surge into the graveyard of empires. And I'm linking in the show file for today's podcast to a great essay by a retired general, William Astor, or Astori, I'm not sure if the E is pronounced. It's over at tomdispatch.com today. And the general makes a number of important points. This is the longest foreign war in our history. The commander there, John Mick Nicholson, is calling for thousands more U.S. troops to break what he called as a stalemate. It's not really a stalemate because the government in Kabul only controls now about 60% of the country. And that is a drop since where we were just 2 years ago. And the essay makes a number of important points that we pretend that we have trained up soldiers for an Afghan army and a national police force. And that's just not true. It's a very spotty force. Many of them are ghost soldiers who get paid but don't work. Definitely don't go into any combat operations. And so General Nicholson was asked, just how many boots do you want on the ground? And he said, well, you know, with 50,000, we could do the job. And that's mind-boggling to imagine that we would try to do this over and over again. It's not Groundhog Day. It is sheer madness. The New Yorker magazine is piling on to the group that believes that Russia hacked the DNC, that Russia hacked the John Podesta email account, that Russia manipulated the outcome of our election. And it's like a 13,000-word cover story that comes complete with some really dark and propagandistic graphics. The title of the New Yorker is put in a Cyrillic text. And I have a couple of comments about this. First of all, based on the New Yorker story, Rachel Maddow on Monday night presented the most persuasive package of information so far, linking Wilbur Ross, the billionaire who was just confirmed as Trump's commerce secretary, who is a longtime crony of Trump's, who has helped bail Trump out when he was running out of money at different points, including, we think, arranging lucrative real estate deals where Russian oligarchs overpaid massively, you know, by like $40 or $60 million for a waterfront home in Florida. And what emerges is a picture of longtime connections of Trump to Russian businessmen. And Wilbur Ross owns a bank in Cyprus, which is a favorite spot where Russians park their money. And in the lengthy package, Rachel inferred that Wilbur Ross may have been the point man, the go-between, between Trump and some of these Russian oligarchs. Now, no new evidence was presented about the hacking and the information that is now treated as fact. And I saw one of the New Yorker reporters on the PBS NewsHour where he did just that. He said, we know that Russia hacked the DNC and John Podesta. And, of course, we still have zero proof of that. And, you know, it's possible that some of these things are true while others are not. But the way this is presented is you either believe it or you're an idiot. And Glenn Greenwald teases out some interesting differences or points from the New Yorker story. One, that President Obama and Hillary Clinton had very radically different views on Russia, that she was often critical of Obama's refusal to pursue aggression and belligerence in his foreign policy, particularly in Syria. The New Yorker article describes Evelyn Farkas, who was at the Pentagon during the Obama administration as senior Russia advisor, became extremely frustrated by Obama's refusal to confront Putin, and then she jumped over to the Hillary campaign. So I think it's an interesting piece, and I have linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. Now, one of the things that Greenwald asserts that I don't really agree, he writes, the post-election Democratic Party orthodoxy on Russia has deliberately obscured the fact that the leading accommodationist of Putin was named Barack Obama. And what some people are calling accommodationist, I think, was real politic on Obama's part. And he made the strategic decision that confronting Russia over Crimea was a lose-lose situation, and I think that's accurate, where Hillary was willing to risk a new Cold War or even a hot war against Russia in order to stand ground there. So I think that's worth noting. Also, there is, let's see what the other points are here. The U.S. media refuses to say if America interferes in Russia's domestic politics. And Greenwald raises an important point here, because we're told that when Obama pulled Putin aside at that meeting in September and said, related to the alleged hacking, cut it out, that Putin responded by saying, you know, you've been meddling in our elections for years, and specifically Hillary did so in, 2011, their parliamentary elections. Greenwald notes, and I appreciate this, the U.S. government still has provided no evidence of its theories about Russian hacking. And there is a fifth point here. Let's see what it is. Fixating on Russia continues to be used to distract from systemic failures of U.S. elites. So check that out. It's a bit lengthy, but I think very interesting and, as usual, provocative from Glenn Greenwald. Devin Nunes is in hot water. He, of course, is the Republican who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, and he is trying to hold on to the ball. He doesn't want an independent prosecutor or other outside investigation of the claims of Russian involvement. But he's got a real conflict of interest because he's been running interference for the Trump administration. And yesterday, apparently referring to classified intelligence that you and I aren't permitted to see, he said, as of right now, I don't have any evidence of phone calls. That doesn't mean they don't exist, but I don't have that. And what I've been told by many folks is that there's nothing there. And who are those folks, Congressman Nunes? Just who are they? Now, he invoked Joe McCarthy and said, we can't just go on a witch hunt. Well, I don't want any witch hunts, and I don't want McCarthyism. But this is a clear conflict, a politicization of whatever investigation may follow. And it is deeply troubling. Over at Shadowproof, Kevin Gostola reports on journalist Rania Kallak. She was supposed to speak. She was invited to speak to the Justice in Palestine chapter at the University of North Carolina. And then the invitation was withdrawn, despite the fact that she was not planning to talk about the conflict in Syria, but students who support the Syrian opposition and who falsely link her to the Assad government, they won the day. And this, again, is troubling because this will not draw any coverage in the corporate media. But a Middle Eastern voice was silenced. And Kallak said that one of her provocateurs, they're trying to sabotage any prospect for me to ever be able to make money, ever be able to feed myself, put a roof over my head. It's McCarthyism at its worst. And it should not be met with shrugs and silence because people are scared of the Syrian issue. This is where people need to have solidarity with journalists. And Max Blumenthal, a friend of this program, has come to her defense. He said a tightly knit network of Syrian regime change activists has composed a de facto blacklist of those who have refused to toe their ruthlessly enforced hypersectarian ideological line. Their goal is to deny the message by destroying the messenger. And Blumenthal, who has also been attacked by the same guy, a fellow named Oz Katterjee, said that he's worked enthusiastically with Israeli aid organizations and demonized leading Palestinian solidarity activists as anti-Semites, including the founder of Electronic Intifada. He freely admits that a campaign is being organized to silence ideological foes like Rania. It's ugly, friends. Free speech, well, it's a relic of the past. It's guaranteed to us in the Fourth Amendment. But I dug up this old little ditty by Harry Shearer, and if the YouTube gods will let me get away with this, I'd like you to hear a little stretch of a tune that he put together back in 1990 called If You Want Free Speech, Go to Russia.
People are taking a stand. We're giving each other a helping hand. Wiping up the crap that's spread all over this land. Your rights stop, or my rights crush you. If you want free speech, go to Russia.
Right. An interesting tactic has been deployed by the two leaders of the House and the Senate and the Assembly here in California, the twin houses of our legislature. And they have resorted to filing under the Federal Freedom of Information Act to force the Trump administration to release details about recent immigration raids. This is a novel tactic, and while I don't have facts, I'll tell you that these are the same two people who hired Eric Holder, the former attorney general, as a special consultant to the state of California, and that may have been his idea. We'll see if coverage reveals that. Meanwhile, the federal appeals court here in San Francisco has turned down a request from the Justice Department to put the appeal of the Seattle trial judge's orders on hold. He's the one who blocked the enforcement of Trump's executive order going back a few weeks. And the administration has been making noises that, don't worry, we're going to withdraw that original one and substitute an amended one. And then maybe you can go and sue about that. But they're trying to end the current legal process. And we don't really know if or when they will actually release or, you know, try to enact a revised version. And I think the Justice Department has taken the right step there. Meanwhile, the impact of the immigration moves, the wall, and the travel ban is very real. In New York, the city is projecting that 300,000 fewer foreigners will visit as tourists this year. Last year, 12.7 million international visitors came to New York, and the estimated loss to the Big Apple is $600 million. And here in San Francisco, the Chronicle reports that online searches for flights to the United States from outside the country dropped by almost 19%, by 18%, on the day that the executive order was put into effect, and on the day of the Florida rally, which was in, about the 18th of February, when Trump was railing on against immigrants and the bad dudes and all that, online searches were down by more than 13%. So it shows that people are looking elsewhere because they don't find the United States a welcoming place to visit these days. Will President Trump honor any of his campaign promises? I mean, some of them were so vague and just slogans, really, that it's hard to know. But in an op-ed published in today's New York Times, actually it was yesterday, Ethan Nadelman, who is the founder and executive director of Drug Policy Alliance, invites the president to honor his pledge. He was, quote, in favor of medical marijuana 100%. He was skeptical of legalizing it more broadly, but he said marijuana policy should basically be left to the states. But that's not what his new attorney general, Jeff Sessions, believes. He's a fervent prohibitionist, and he is threatening to make life difficult for the states where medical marijuana is legal and the eight states where adult use has been approved by voters. Now, a poll just last week showed that voters in the U.S. favor legalization by 59% to 36%, and an impressive 71%, including majorities of Republicans and older voters, think the federal government should not interfere in states that have legalized marijuana. And finally, we reported last week on Uber's difficulties, including a sexual harassment claim from a female engineer. Well, today's target is the electric car company Tesla. And an engineer, a woman named A.J. Vandermeiden, has gone public accusing them of pervasive harassment, sexism, and unequal treatment with men. And this comes on a day when Uber announced it has fired one of the people who was accused of sexual harassment there. Ill treatment of women, lack of representation in the workforce in the tech industry, and Silicon Valley in particular, is quite widespread. And these courageous women are standing up and stepping forward to tell their stories, and I hope that it will induce change. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. You can share it everywhere. And if I get that music clip past YouTube, this podcast will be featured there too.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.